morning.
Morning, morning.
So, in case you haven't had your TV on in a few weeks, this week is election week. Tuesday is election day. And I encourage you to do your homework, do your research, to get out there and vote. Vote for what matters to you. And hopefully that means what matters to God's kingdom. Church will never tell you how to vote. That's not our place. But if you're anything like me, it's not always easy to vote. You get into the booth and sometimes the decisions are hard because there's no perfect candidate. I remember my first time that I went into the booth to vote. I did so much work on like the president and the senator and the representative, and I was really surprised by all the other questions. Lots of names that I didn't know. I didn't know who the school board people were. I didn't know who the local state representatives were. And I got so caught up in these quote-unquote big picture pieces that I forgot about all the really important, sometimes arguably more important, local decisions that there were to be made. And it's hard because, again, there's no perfect candidate. It's hard to find candidates that have positions that agree with the things that you want and have a character and lifestyle that you can get behind. I mean, many of us use the illustration that sometimes it feels like we have to hold our nose as we go in and vote. And if you tell somebody who you voted for afterwards, whether it's on the right or the left-hand side of things, you'll have people who say, how could you as a Christian vote for that person? Well, if you feel that way, if you wrestle with that, and I hope that you wrestle with that, you're not alone. In fact, through history and through the history of Scripture, we see that this is a common occurrence, maybe not in the voting booth, but that God accomplishes His purpose in conjunction with very flawed people. Because this place isn't our home. And none of us are honestly perfect either. A book that I read many years ago was called No Perfect People Allowed. When we were pastoring in Ohio, we put it up on our sign, and even the newspaper was, what does this mean? Well, the truth is we're all affected by sin. We're the way we think, the way we feel, the things that we get passionate about, we have to be careful. And we live in a world that's completely tainted by sin. Again, heaven is our home. This place isn't. But as we look through the history of Scripture, we see so many times that God accomplishes His purpose by joining God's people with those that are very flawed and very broken in the world. Not too long before, again, we went through this series on Genesis that brought us into Exodus, and we saw Joseph. Joseph was able to use his relationship with a very flawed Pharaoh at the time to save the entire ancient Near East as he interpreted the dreams and he helped build grain silos to store the surplus. Later through Scripture, we'll see the story of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar was a very flawed, broken, at points evil king. But yet God used him and God used Daniel's relationship with him to do a tremendous amount of good. We see God used Balaam's donkey. God even speaks through the animals. And here we see Pharaoh's daughter. These unlikely collaborators that because of the faith and the obedience of those around them end up being used to advance God's kingdom, God's purposes. So while it may be tempting to just turn our back and walk away from these things because there is no perfect person or there is no perfect candidate, we remember that God uses flawed people and that faith is contagious. One of my favorite stories is that of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis wrote the Chronicles of Narnia. He wrote, in fact, is probably one of my favorite Christian authors of all time. But many don't understand that C.S. Lewis, even into his adult life, was a devout atheist. He became friends at Oxford University with J.R. Tolkien, who you might remember from the Lord of the Rings books and other stories. And it was one day when they were walking together at the zoo. C.S. Lewis had been doing so much work and effort trying to disprove the scriptures because of his relationship, because of his friendship with Tolkien. And it was one day when they were at the zoo when everything clicked. And all of a sudden the scales came off his eyes and he became a believer. And not just any believer. He became one of the most prolific Christian writers, Christian influences we know. Now again, I want to be clear because some people will take things to extremes. Especially for my kids who might hear this. God is not calling for us to go out and find a non-Christian spouse or non-Christian boyfriend or girlfriend. That's missionary dating, doesn't work very well. God tells us we're not to be unequally yoked. He's not calling us to go out and start a business with a non-believer. The scripture is very clear about that, that we have to share values. But there will be other times in life that God brings flawed people, broken people, into our lives, and He will use them to accomplish His purpose, and He will use us to draw them near to God as we are image bearers of God. So it's through our relationship with them that they get to know Christ. And that's what we see here in the story of Moses and Pharaoh's daughter. I want to begin by looking at Amram and Jochebed's faith. In Exodus 2, verses 1 through 3, "Now a man from the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds in the bank of the Nile." Make no mistake, the stakes here for Moses' parents, for Amram and Jochebed, were high. Pharaoh had given the order that every Hebrew boy must be killed at birth. He started first with the midwives. He told the midwives to terminate the pregnancy before the baby was born. But the midwives said that the Hebrew women were much more strong and robust than the Egyptian women. And they'd often give birth before they got there. So the children continued to be born. But finally, Pharaoh got his way. And there was this awful genocide. This awful thing began to happen. The stakes were high. They were risking their lives. In fact, Pharaoh would have most certainly made an example out of their entire family. So Aaron and Miriam, their lives were at stake too. Pharaoh wouldn't have just punished the parents. He would have blotted out their whole line. So it's a brave and it's a bold thing for them to defy Pharaoh in such a way. And it makes me wonder, is the threat of death less when you're under such intense persecution? Is this one of the reasons we talked about last week that the church grows, the family of God grows and develops more under persecution than under good times? Because when you're being persecuted, when things are so hard, maybe heaven seems like an okay alternative. Maybe death isn't so bad when this world is so harsh and so awful. That faith becomes a little bit easier. That the risk doesn't seem so much. On the contrary, for many of us who live comfortable suburban lives, we can set the thermostat right where we like it. We've got a comfortable house. Obviously, just like me, we don't struggle too much to find food. Things aren't so bad. We want to watch our kids grow up and get married and have grandchildren. We want all of these suburban nice things. But in doing so, the fear of losing that may keep us from stepping out in faith, from risking everything like Amram and Jacob did. In the same way, I've heard stories, and I've done ministry in the inner city in some very dangerous neighborhoods. And I think it's hard for us sometimes, we don't live there, to understand, you know, why a young man might join a gang when it's so risky and so dangerous, or might go choose to sell drugs on the corner when it feels like that's throwing their life away. But when they've grown up, not seen very many young men make it into adulthood, when they've grown up seeing so much turmoil, it just becomes accepted that this is where their future is. They have to make something of themselves while they have it. I think there are similar dynamics in this intense persecution that doesn't take away from the faith that Moses' parents have. In fact, their faith is one of the, so we look at the Hebrews chapter 11 passage, we call it the Hall of Fame of Scripture. It says the faith is commended of so many, but Amram and Jochebed make it there. In Hebrews 11, verse 23 and 24, it says, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. And by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So their faith not only saved Moses, and again, Moses has a lot in the journey left as he's floating in the Nile River. He's not saved yet. He's just in a better spot than he would have been if his parents had fulfilled or followed through with the king's edict. But he gets to make it to the next step. And that faith is contagious. We see it's contagious because later we see in Miriam, a young child standing off on the sidelines watching what her parents do. And the faith of her parents becomes a faith that she adopts, and it becomes a faith that later Moses adopts, and it's a faith that even affects Pharaoh's daughter. Second thing I want to draw our attention to is Bithya's compassion. In Exodus chapter 2, verse 5, we read, when Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking among the riverbank, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Well, the text here doesn't give us the name of Pharaoh's daughter. Rabbinic tradition and the Midrash identify her name in the genealogies. Like Rahab, the prostitute that let the people of Israel into Jericho, she is celebrated in Jewish tradition. And the name they find for her is Bithya. Now, in Jewish tradition, Bithya is actually, because of the relationship she has with Moses' family, that she herself comes to the place of salvation, even living in such a wicked household. She herself has her mind changed, and she is pointed to become a worshiper of God. Now, I don't know all of that. The scriptures don't make that clear, but rabbinic tradition claims that, and sometimes there's a little more history there than what we have in the scriptures alone. But either way, we see this tremendous act of compassion from someone we would not otherwise expect. See, when Bithya saw Moses in the basket floating in the Nile, something quite amazing happens. Even though she's very different, even though her father is committing genocide against the Hebrew people, even though her Egyptian brothers and sisters hate and are jealous of the Hebrew people. She sees this baby in the basket and she has compassion on him, knowing full well that he's one of the Hebrew babies. I like to say that we all have our own Samaritans. If we look in the scriptures, especially in the New Testament, we remember the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman by the well. To the Jews, the Samaritans were somehow less than. They looked down upon them. And today, all of us, we have our own prejudice. We have our own people we look at. Maybe it's not what the media says. Maybe it's not about skin color. Maybe it's not about religion or faith. But for some people, during the COVID, it was those who wore masks looked down upon those who didn't. And those maybe who didn't wear masks looked down upon those who did. Those who were excited about the vaccines and those who weren't. I saw lots of anger and frustration, and it was real life stakes, so I understand. Maybe it's those of different faiths from us. Maybe it's those who've made different decisions or live in different places. I have a hard time on Facebook because I get on Facebook and I see leaders of other churches that I know very well, and I see the things they post, and it's like, wow. If half of America saw those words, they would realize they weren't even welcome in that church. Because they say such angry and emotionally driven things. So while we might not look down on people of different skin colors, and if we're honest, maybe some of us do. We all have that group that we look down upon if we're not careful. And that's something that we have to bring before the Lord and we have to confess. But Pharaoh's daughter here did something amazing. Even though she was steeped and raised in hatred towards the Hebrew people, she sees this baby and she has compassion upon him. Make no mistake, Bithya could have gone and really asked for anyone to bear her child. It would have been a privilege in Egyptian society to bear a child as a surrogate for the Pharaoh's daughter. That child becomes royalty. It's adopted into the royal family. You're forever connected. It's amazing to me. I didn't know how much, how many games and how many shenanigans were played in the royal family stuff in Britain. That going or getting your daughter into the school that the princes were in was a big deal, because your daughter might meet them on the quad or in gym class or the cafeteria, and you may become part of the royal family. And so there's all of this scheming and activity that's done to try and get close. Well, anyone would have been happy to bear or even give their child to Pharaoh's daughter to raise. But she here chooses to defy her father, her genocidal, angry father. And we'll see just how wicked he is as we go through the story of the plagues, and how much he's willing to inflict upon his people out of his stubbornness when he sees the miracles of God happen. As he hardens his own heart so many times that God finally hardens it for him. She's going against her people. Again, if they found out that in Pharaoh's home, if this wasn't kept a secret, they brought in a Hebrew child, then everything, all the work that was done to quell the anger and the jealousy of the other Egyptians would have been undone. This was no small thing. And again, it was a brave act. It was an act of courage. And it was only possible because of the courageous faith of Moses' parents. It's a basketball analogy, and it says you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Now, putting Moses in that basket was no guarantee. But if they hadn't, then the next step, then Bithya never would have been able to see him in the Nile, and she never would have been able to rescue him. She never would have been able to continue this thing that God was doing. And finally, we see Miriam's wisdom. In Exodus chapter 2, verse 4, first, his sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then verse 7, then his sister asked Pharaoh, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. Miriam has to be my favorite person in this story. And the word wisdom might not even be the right one. I wrestled with this. It was so hard to define in one word the characteristics that she shows here. There's wisdom, but there's courage and there's faith. There's also a lot of tact and decisiveness. I mean, think about it. She learned so much faith watching her parents, observing them, even from a distance at points, watching them release her baby brother into God's hands via the Nile River. I'm reminded of formative experiences in my own life, watching my parents in small groups and Bible studies, spend time in prayer, being taught, just watching the men in the church pray together and being invited in, being taken downtown to some of the food pantries, to the Inasmuch Ministry, where we filled bags and we served and we handed out groceries and we served food. And I watched from a distance as my parents were faithful and teaching Sunday school classes and other things, and that influenced me and it gave me faith and boldness to take that next step. It became part of my identity. And I believe that was the case for Miriam. But here she has wonderful timing and tact, so decisive for the right moment. Because if she had gone in too soon, Pharaoh's daughter would have certainly said, "Is this some kind of a trick? Who are you and how are you so closely connected to this child? Is this your baby? Is this your family's baby?" There would have been skepticism. But if she waited any longer, this crazy idea to become a mother that Pharaoh's daughter had, that Bithya had, may have kind of fleeted away. You've been there, I've been there, where there's this moment like, that would be great and courageous and exciting. And then 15 minutes later, you're like, "No, that was a terrible idea. I'm not going to do it." But when Miriam comes in, what does she say? She immediately comes in and she says, "Shall I go and get for you one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" She provides an action step to seal the deal, to make this baby her own. And she comes in at the perfect time to make the connection. So that not only is Pharaoh's daughter being used by God to accomplish God's purpose, but she's being blessed with a relationship, a friendship now, with Miriam, with Amram, with Aaron, with Jochebed. See, this family, like we said before, gets to be the hands and feet of God in the life of this very influential young woman. And this unlikely alliance, this unlikely friendship begins. And if the rabbis are correct, it leads to the salvation of this young Egyptian woman who lived in a very evil time, in a very evil family. See, God doesn't just use people. But when people are used to accomplish His purpose, He draws them near to Him, often by drawing them near to us as image bearers of God. Again, wisdom may not be the best descriptor here, but she shows great timing and tact and wisdom and courage. Pains me to think about how many times I've failed to be as decisive as Miriam, as she is here, where God sets the table, where God makes preparation, even in front of influential people, but where I, for whatever reason, maybe I'm afraid, maybe I'm worried that this will end that relationship and the stakes are too high. Maybe I'm worried that they'll reject the offer that I make. But for whatever reason, God sets the table and I walk away with my head down. Afraid I would be too intimidated by their status, or maybe that I'd embarrass myself. In college, I met an evangelist. He came and he spoke to us, and he was an interesting guy. He was just finishing up a 40-day fast. And when I say 40-day fast, not a 40-day, I'm going to drink Slim Fast fast. It's a 40-day, no food. And he looked frail and weak. He had his last few days there as he was with us for a spiritual renewal week on campus. And he was a tall guy. He actually played college basketball with Charles Barkley. And they became lifelong friends. And he tells the story that one day he was invited to go have a night on the town with Charles Barkley and Charles' good friend, Michael Jordan. And so they're in the limo, and he's with, you know, the greatest basketball player of all time. I still think today Michael Jordan's face, if not his outline on the shoe, is one of the most recognizable people out there. And he's in the limo. And he said part of him thought, you know what, if I just stay cool and hang out, that I'll be invited back another time. But who knows? You know, you're in this kind of rare air moment. But he chose to take that moment, and he chose to share his testimony and his story of how he accepted Christ and Michael Jordan. Now, we all would hope that the story would end where Michael would fall on his knees and say, I need the Jesus that you're talking about. Didn't happen in that moment. But there was mutual respect. Everyone else in the limo was pretty surprised that as the champagne was flowing and the cigars were burning, that this was the topic of conversation. And no, he never did get an invite back to party with Michael Jordan. But God provided the opportunity. And who knows if that was a seed planted or a seed watered. Or maybe a weed pulled. Only God knows. But the question is, for you or for I, if God sets the table, if He makes the preparation, are we turning our back on people of peace because we're intimidated by their status and their position? Because they're not perfect people? Oh, God wouldn't team up with that person. Do you know what they've done? When I was at a large church, I was working on building quite a few leaders and developing them for small group ministry, and I had over 100 names on a list. And the group of elders handed me back the list, and only 3 names were left, not crossed off. They said, well, you know, they had a divorce once, and they don't tithe enough. And I'm like, how do you even know that? That's weird. And one by one, they disqualified. They don't believe the earth is young enough. They don't believe. And they were peripheral issues. They were issues of people who were growing in their faith. None of us are perfect. So if we disqualified them to do work in God's kingdom because we see some of the other mess in their lives, because just like God with Miriam and Amram and Jochebed, He is providing, He is cultivating and setting up people of peace in our lives. But they may not be the people we expect. They may be a little rough around the edges. But as God is calling to use them to develop and expand His kingdom, He may be calling us to be the hands and feet, His hands and feet to them. That He would draw them near to Himself by drawing them near to us. So again, I'm reminded that courage is contagious. If we show courage and and faith. Those around us will see it. And maybe that's your neighbors. Could be your grandkids or your great-grandkids or your children, co-workers, people you volunteer with. As you go out on a limb and say, okay, God, I'm going to do this. Probably won't be riding in a limo with Michael Jordan sharing your faith. But maybe it's an opportunity to share your faith with the mayor or some official. Maybe it's the boss at work. Worship team, you can come forward.